Good morning.
The following takes place between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m.
You know, digital terrorism feels so very last season.
Now tell me what we're dealing with.
A device to hack through the CIP firewall. Irregularities in their air traffic control system.
Are you saying commercial flights are in danger?
Possibly.
What's going to happen? I mean, crashing a couple planes is really nothing compared to contaminating the water system or bringing down the power grid.
Don't think about it, Janice. Just stay on task.
The real threat from so-called cyber terrorism is more boring and less understood than a TV drama. It may even be more threatening than your average Jack Bauer.
You want my help, you want my advice, take it. You don't, don't. I don't care.
We care. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Events occur in real time.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, May 28th. I'm John Hockenberry along with Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
I prefer to time travel. It's actually yesterday for me. But anyway, coming up this hour, we'll tell you what you need to know about the rocky week ahead for GM and Chrysler. Plus, we're going to look for possible winds of change in Iran. We'll go to Tehran, where our partners at the BBC will take us inside the pivotal election there. All this and more ahead, but first the headlines.
And in the headlines today, President Obama hosts Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This is the latest in a series of White House meetings on the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, was here last week. Fixing the economy should be every bit as challenging as the Middle East peace process, but President Obama says it's getting better.
When you look at the economy right now, I think it's safe to say that we have step back from the brink, that there is some calm that didn't exist before.
The calm president was in Beverly Hills, where the economy is a little different. He was at a speech during a Hollywood fundraiser. Farai?
Well, excuse me, tension is ramping up between the U.S. and North Korea. The American and South Korean troops along the border are boosting their alert level. This comes after a new threat of military moves by North Korea yesterday. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Pyongyang's behavior is disturbing.
It continues to act in a provocative and belligerent manner toward its neighbors. There are consequences to such actions.
The U.S. has long had a significant military presence in South Korea, and right now there are nearly 30,000 American troops there, plus tens of thousands more in nearby Japan. We're going to get brand new data on the economy coming out starting later this hour. We've got key reports due on jobs and big-ticket factory products. We're watching that. We'll bring it to you live with analysis.
Escalation in Pakistan. The Taliban now says it has launched the attack on Pakistan's intelligence agencies. Wednesday's suicide attack killed dozens and wounded more than 300. At least one man is dead after a 7.1 magnitude quake hit just off the coast of Honduras. In sports, all the sports this morning, the Lakers on the verge of the NBA Finals. They took a 3-2 series lead over the Nuggets last night. In the Western Conference, in the East, Orlando leads Cleveland 3-1. The Magic play the Cavaliers tonight. And on the ice, the Stanley Cup is set. It'll be the Red Wings against the Pittsburgh Penguins. The S&P starts trading at 893. Both the S&P and Dow lost around 2% yesterday, and we are dancing this morning on The Takeaway. Did you get jiggy back in 1998?
Bring it. Yeah.
We really want to know, what was your big dance song? Kind of fun here on The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll pair you with the song, and you can be dancing again.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. How's this for a milestone? General Motors is 100 years old. It turned 100 in 2008. Here's another milestone. It's about to file for bankruptcy. We begin on The Takeaway with some U.S. economic history in the making. Anticipated an imminent bankruptcy of General Motors and apparently Chrysler Corporation. They both will make American legal and financial history because of the scale of these bankruptcies. And if they actually succeed, it'll be like nothing we've ever seen on many, many levels. Joining us to talk about this is Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent at the New York Times, and John Pato, the law professor at the University of Michigan. Both join us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, where from their perspective, the details of these bankruptcies and restructurings are actually starting to emerge. Micheline, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Let's talk about how people can really understand what's going on here. It seems to me the most important thing to understand is that the complexity of these bankruptcies relates to the fact that both Chrysler and GM got way into debt before getting to this point. So there are a lot of debtors here that have to be dealt with and a lot for judges to do. Mickey?
There's a combination of things first. These companies were laden with cost. Debt is part of it. Operating cost is another. And when on top of all of that, the car market just collapsed on them. I'm not sure if they'd be in great shape if we weren't in this recession, but this recession really was the final blow to them operating as independent companies.
John Pato, a law professor at the University of Michigan, remind us what the complexity is here with all of these creditors standing in line, crowding into court. I don't know what it actually looks like, but the scale of both of these bankruptcies, should they proceed, and again, it's not official, are going to be like nothing we've seen.
Yeah, this is probably going to be the biggest, I don't know if it's going to be the biggest in actual dollar amounts, but certainly the biggest in economic significance bankruptcy we've seen, I can think, ever maybe. You'd have to have a pretty big courtroom to get every single one of the creditors of General Motors in, including you and me as taxpayers, by the way. But what will happen is there'll be secured creditors, that's to say lenders and banks who have got collateral for their loans, you know, where GM's pledged assets, and they'll get paid. And then there'll be priority creditors who are certain creditors like employees or taxing authorities that the bankruptcy code says deserve to be paid ahead of other creditors, and they'll be filing claims. Then there'll be general unsecured creditors like bondholders, people who have invested. They come in there, and then you've got good old stockholders and preferred stockholders who are technically filing claims, but will be wiped out and their claims will be worthless.
You know, the irony here, John, is that while the bondholders appear by your reckoning to be at the bottom end of the sort of creditor list, they also have the power to actually trigger this bankruptcy by basically saying, hey, we're not taking any sort of deal. You pay us now or go into bankruptcy. They have power and then none.
That's right, and I think what they're doing is they're negotiating right now, and these eve of bankruptcy back and forths are sort of like a big game of chicken. The company says, you know, here's our recent proposal, and it was to swap the bond debt for equity in new GM, and they said, listen, if you guys don't take this, bondholders, we're going to have to end up filing for bankruptcy. And the bondholders, at least I saw the vote was like 90% of them said, no, we don't think that's good enough. We'll take our chances in bankruptcy. But it's a pretty risky strategy because the valuation I saw most recently pegs these bondholders at getting between 0 and 10 cents on the dollar at most.
Wow. Great investment.
And, you know, left holding the bag or getting a sweetheart deal, depending on what what your point of view is, of course, the U.S. government. And I just want to keep this really tight. How do you think it affects consumers, if at all,
Mickey?
That the government will hold so big of a stake in
right,
these?
The government has already said that people who purchase cars from Chrysler, which is in bankruptcy already, and from General Motors, while it's in bankruptcy, their warranties will be backed by the federal government. I don't know how that's going to actually work in reality. You know, if your car dies on a freeway, you know, do you call Tim Geithner or is there an 800 number?
But call your senator.
That's what they've said, and they wanted to clear up any question about buying vehicles from them because it's really the government putting them into bankruptcy, and, you know, the government has to kind of look out for you as well.
And, John, I know that you're looking at the legal structuring of this kind of a deal as opposed to the auto industry per se and its future, but do you have any thoughts on whether or not a government, you know, owned, largely owned company will be different in terms of, for example, Hummers were incredibly popular due to market forces, but the government has a lot of interest that would go against building a vehicle like that. Now they're no longer popular even on the agenda of production. But if you had a sudden consumer demand for a gas guzzler, would the government just shoot it down?
Yeah, that's the $64 question, which is, will the government now, which they could be owning up to 70% of the equity of GM. They only, and I'm now making on radio the air quotes, they only own about 10% of Chrysler, but they could be owning up to 70% of GM. And so the question is, are they going to be like any other investor and say, let's make this company as profitable as possible? Or are they going to be, and you know, we're taxpayers, are they going to be like the government? Are they going to try to effectuate government policy through leveraging their control of GM? So they're going to say, listen, we don't care how profitable they are. We want you to start making, you know, green cars because that's what our carbon emission goals are by the government.
John, have you ever ridden Amtrak, buddy?
I have. It wasn't on time when I wrote it.
Right. I don't think you necessarily – I think you may have your answer there. In the few minutes before we go, though, Mickey, let's take a look at one incident that John was talking about there. Chrysler spent 9 hours in bankruptcy court dealing with some secured debt holders, all right, who hold about 1% of Chrysler's secured debt. And they're a member of, like, Indiana state pension funds and construction funds. And that was, like, the crucial to the entire Chrysler deal. Can you explain any of this?
Well, what they were arguing was that, first of all, the case shouldn't be heard in New York, which would sort of throw a big ball of wax into the whole thing. And they were also arguing, they came up with a lot of really great stuff as far as those were listening. Apparently, there are a bunch of emails that were indicating that even the lawyers were thinking that the case was moving too quickly and that there were some very angry exchanges between attorneys for the debt holders at Chrysler and the government. And it was apparently quite a vivid situation in the courtroom yesterday. But the point was that they argued that this should not be in bankruptcy court. This was another matter. And the judge basically said, you know, I'm not moving the case. So the drama will continue today.
Right. And of course, the question really is, can Chrysler get out from under enough of this stuff for it to still be attractive to Fiat? What do you think, Mickey?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I think Fiat will go through with this. In fact, people expecting sale to go through yesterday, but it won't go through until some more of these objections have been heard.
Well, John Pato, let's go back then to the general point. I think, you know, Farai raised it with the issue of what's the point of the government owning 75% of something that appears worthless. Stepping back, and again, you're a law professor, is there a business here when judges look at what's left of General Motors? Is there a business?
I think there is. I think the good news, so putting on my optimistic hat of having the government involved, is that they do have a business plan. They're massively slashing their bloated dealer network. They are rationalizing, downsizing their number of brands, and they have a plan. The problem is when you're as big as General Motors, you're a financial behemoth that it's hard to get financing for. So the U.S. government's ponying up and said, listen, we'll provide financing so you can survive a reorganization, but we can't just write you a blank check. We have to take something. So we are going to take this giant equity stake. It's not like we're looking to buy investments in the car industry. We're just doing this because we can't tell the taxpayers we're giving you free money. So I take them, you know, maybe I'm naive, but I'm taking them at face value when they say we are becoming reluctant shareholders of General Motors. Well, so it could very well work out. They have a smaller, more profitable business going forward in a couple of years, and then the government owns up to, you know, some huge equity stake in it. The one group I don't want you to forget about is when we talk about these unsecured creditors and the bondholders, the biggest unsecured creditor is the UAW.
Right.
GM's made all these promises about health care, pensions, and stuff.
And they've put a small amount of money up. They'll have a certain equity stake. Before we go, what is the chance that the U.S. government may actually end up taking those pension liabilities and health care liabilities and just folding them into the federal government, that would be the end game here?
Well, they sort of can do that already with something called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is when companies get really screwed up in their pensions, they basically just give up and say, we can't fund our pensions anymore, and they turn it over to the government. We already have a government entity that does that.
So a possible positive thing for workers who are listening this morning. Mickey, you want to call the Red Wings?
Oh, my gosh. Of course it's going to be a repeat. Are you kidding? I have a bet with Jack Spear over this.
And we'll make sure Jack Spear pays up if you win, Mickey. That's great. We've got all your Stanley Cup and Detroit bankruptcy news here on The Takeaway all rolled into one. Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent at The New York Times. Her mom calls her Micheline. And John Pato, law professor at the University of Michigan, both joined us from Ann Arbor this morning. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with John Hockenberry, and in some very serious international news, we're tracking the presidential elections in Iran. The crowd this week for a speech by the opposition candidate Mir Mousavi was important not just because 30,000 people showed up. The supporters hadn't been paid, fed, or bused in to attend, tactics used by the incumbent, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Some of them got there after being recruited on Facebook. In response, the Iranian government blocked access to the social networking site for much of this week. And for a deeper look at how the campaign is heating up, we spoke with BBC correspondent John Lyne in Tehran earlier this morning. I asked Lyne what role the internet is playing, not just in the current elections, but in Iran as a whole, and if he was friends with Mousavi on Facebook.
Not personally. I do follow the internet here. Of course, it's quite an important important society here, actually, obviously because of the restrictions there are on the press and the media. A lot of people blog here. We're estimated to be 60,000 bloggers out of a population of 70 million. And remember, not everybody, not even majority of the country probably have internet access. But for young people here, the internet is a really crucial tool in not so much politics, but certainly society and even socializing, more important than I would think almost anywhere else in the world.
Mousavi comes from the same village as Ayatollah Khomeini. Is that correct?
That's right, the supreme leader. It's curious, this village of Khomeini. When you become an Ayatollah, you take on a new name, which is the name where you come from. So he's Ayatollah Khomeini because he's from the village of Khomeini, which is up in the northwest. It's the Iranian part of Azerbaijan. So people speak the Turkic language up there, very close to the Turkish language. They come Ayatollah Khomeini and Mir Hossein Mousavi, the leading opposition contender, come from this same village, just 3 years apart. So they probably knew each other growing up. And the impression I get is a great kind of tale that they were from either side of the tracks. Mr. Mousavi was the smarter one. I mean, it's smarter in terms of more wealthy. And Ayatollah Khomeini was from a poorer family. And they've worked together in harness. Mir Hossein Mousavi was the prime minister from 1980 to 88 or 81 to 89, when they used to have prime ministers here. And Ayatollah Khomeini in those days wasn't supreme leader, he was the president. So it really, you could write a novel about it, really, about where these two people are coming from. But at the moment, I think they're not political allies, because from everything we've seen, Ayatollah Khomeini is giving increasing support to President Ahmadinejad's re-election bid. I was at an Ahmadinejad rally yesterday, and it was interesting. They had a lot of posters printed up that had President Ahmadinejad's picture beside that of Ayatollah Khomeini, and he wouldn't have done that unless he'd had the green light from the supreme leader. Otherwise, he would have got his knuckles very severely rapped.
You know, one of my friends who's a correspondent who's gone back and forth to Iran as a reporter says that it's hard getting the right papers from the government to go in, but the people themselves are quite friendly. What are people saying to you? Have you been able to talk to any potential voters, and how are they making their decisions?
Yeah, of course, I speak to voters every day of the week. You're right. I mean, the Iranian people are great. I mean, that's the great plus of being here, whatever you think of the government. The Iranian people are smart, are extremely friendly, very, very welcome to foreigners. One of the most pleasant bunch of people I've met in reporting from around the world. Very, very, they really take the initiative. They're very dynamic society. And anyway, what I have found in this election campaign increasingly is that it is divided absolutely down the middle into two countries. You've got the sort of people who are supporting Mir Hossein Mousavi, or particularly the sort of people he's trying to recruit, which are the younger generation, those bright, smart, English-speaking people, women wearing a headscarf, but almost certainly not the full black chador, you know, the full black cloak.
Right.
Whereas by contrast, President Ahmadinejad is appealing to very much the lower class, poorer, less educated constituency at his rally, almost every single one of the women was wearing the full black chador, the full black cloak. That's not enforced by law here. You've got to wear a headscarf, but you haven't got to go a whole way. So he's are the more religious, the more fundamentalist, the much less educated people who see him. Some of them see him almost, I have to say, almost worship him, really. Incredible adulation for President Ahmadinejad in that section of society. By contrast, the people, particularly the people around me here in, I would say I live in a slightly smarter area of North Tehran, they dislike him, and many of them have contempt for Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Now, the Islamic Revolution was really all about a reaction against the intellectual class in Iran, and I'm wondering, you know, well over a generation out, if that's still playing out. You've got the lower class Ahmadinejad fundamentalist conservatives versus a kind of reform-minded youth culture that is very much, as you say, the smart set. Is that going to play out in this election exactly that way?
I would really question that original assumption. The revolution was a very complicated thing we're still trying to come to terms with. But it was certainly supported by a lot of very smart people. And I think that was one of the big failings of the West's analysis at the time. They saw the people leading the revolution, particularly the religious leaders, as not very clever. And I can tell you, the people running this country, maybe they don't appear very clever to you sometimes from the outside, but I can tell you there's some smart people running this country. Whether they're running it in the best interest of the country and the best interest of the Iranian people, that one could dispute heavily.
Right.
But there are certainly some very smart people. And I think that, yes, there is, but there is a fundamental contradiction that I totally agree with you, that is going to play out over the coming decades.
Well, a lot of information right there. We were talking about Iran's presidential election. My guest was BBC correspondent John Line. He joined us from Tehran for that interview conducted earlier this morning, John.
And we're having a dance party on this side of the hemisphere on The Takeaway. Bust a Move, the song, is turning 20. It was the big dance song in 1989. We want to know, what was the big dance song when you were going out?
For me, it always was and probably always will be Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels doing the medley Devil with the Blue Dress and Good Golly, Miss Molly. It came out like in 1967. I think if I were weak and drawing my last breath and that song came on, I could still get up and dance.
The song that gets you up, 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now, Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Ahead of the president's meeting with his Palestinian counterpart today, the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made the White House stance on the West Bank settlements crystal clear. She says that there should be a stop to all settlements. The Israeli government's response this morning says that the future of those settlements will be determined through negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Soldiers at Fort Campbell in Kentucky stopped regular duties today to focus on suicide prevention. The base averaged about a suicide a week in the first 3 months of the year, and there were two more last week. The head of the chaplains for the base pointed to the frequency of division deployment as a cause for soldier stress. And in international news, a roadside bombing in Baghdad has killed a U.S. soldier. That happened yesterday. That makes May the deadliest month for the American military since September of last year. Let's look at stories topping the news this morning. For John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with John Hockenberry, and you know, life isn't all revolutions and famines. We are having a dance party this morning on The Takeaway. The song Bust a Move is turning 20, and that's just one example of a sort of generational moment where hip-hop became blended with pop, and we wore a lot of bad clothing, those of us who were around then. Now, we want to know, what was the big dance song when you first started to go out? Jay in the control room remembers bopping to this 90s J-Lo classic. I have spent all of my life waiting for tonight. Oh. That's just Jenny from the block, but back when she was totally on the dance tip. All right, 877-8-MY-TAKE. I think Eric B. and Rakim was much more my style, but I could rock the J-Lo. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to know about your egregious fashion police arrests. We want to know about the music you listen to. Send us pictures of you in your dancing clothes at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
We are actually putting together a slideshow, so we hope we get a deluge of pictures of you in those fabulous, fabulous duds back when you were dancing and clubbing. So you may have noticed, if you go to the movies or if you watch 24 or dramas on television, that Hollywood producers love cyber terrorism. You know why? It's really easy to shoot. You just shoot people with stern expressions on their faces, sitting in front of computers, blips. You run some scary music, maybe one shot of something blowing up, and hey, you've got a movie, all right? But there's some reality to cyber terrorism, as it's called. Here's CIA Director Leon Panetta during his first public speech on May 18th.
The whole area of cybersecurity is a huge threat to this country and to the world in ways that we haven't even begun to understand.
And to help us understand, the Obama administration plans to unveil a much-anticipated report on his plans to deal with Internet security. And he may name something called a cybersecurity czar, which the administration claims it needs in this era. Well, to try to understand what the threat actually is and to figure out who's responsible for securing us from this threat is James Lewis. He consulted the administration while they worked on this report. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he's director of the Center's Technology and Public Policy Program. We want to spend a few minutes with him. James, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
You know, if you watch 24, the threat is that somebody with a weird card can plug into a USB port and suddenly take down a power grid in some city. How do you see the reality of the so-called digital internet threat?
You know, somebody with a weird card could plug something into a USB port and take down the power grid in a region. It's just that people aren't going to do that for fun. It would have to be a big crisis. You know, if we ever get into a fight with the Chinese or the Russians, you're going to see cyber-triggered blackouts. It's just part of warfare anymore. The real threat, though, is espionage, because that happens every day. It's something where we lose valuable secrets. It's economic espionage, military espionage. That's where we're getting hurt.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who's responsible for that. I mean, a government has secrets in its, or a company has secrets in its safe. It buys a safe, it puts up a fence, and secures its own proprietary secrets from the outside world. Where is it the government's responsibility to secure and pay for the infrastructure to protect proprietary secrets of American corporations in the internet sphere?
Well, I don't think they should pay. That's like saying that the government should pay for the airlines to keep their airplanes safe. But that's kind of the model we want to look at. You have the FAA. They make sure the airlines inspect their aircraft to keep them safe. You have the FDA. They look at food and drugs to make sure they're safe. The government has a role to make sure that the private sector is living up to its responsibilities when it comes to things like cybersecurity or espionage.
Is there a tension, as there was at the FDA, between protecting proprietary information in the form of regulation and in protecting consumers? And if we're talking about the internet, protecting consumers from more of an attack versus protecting consumers from the impact of cyber espionage that steals things from corporations?
Yeah, I think that there's two parts of the problem. The first is the espionage problem. That's a national problem. It's not going to affect your average consumer, right? People stealing the secrets of nuclear weapons, not an immediate threat. Long-term threat, yeah. Near-term, though, there's risk to consumers. And, of course, everyone worries about identity theft and having their bank account cleaned out. That really doesn't happen that often, but it's a worry. And I think one of the things that people are concerned about is over time, there will be a reluctance to use the internet for any sort of real business transactions, and we want to avoid that kind of situation.
That's interesting. As security degrades on the internet, as the internet becomes a much more global, ubiquitous phenomenon, does it change the national model? Is there a digital model of nations where governments pay for a kind of digital containment that surrounds each country, and that there is no longer a global internet? There are just bubbles around industrialized nations?
You know, that would be a bad outcome, because one of the benefits of the internet is this huge increase in connectivity that lets you look at things all around the world. Not to say there aren't countries that look that are looking at that. The Chinese, for example, are probably trying to set up some kind of national network, so in the event of a crisis, they could disconnect and still operate nationally, but they wouldn't be linked globally. Overall, though, we want to keep this as a global network, and that's another reason to build up the security.
Finally, what does an internet or a cybersecurity czar do if we get an announcement of one by the end of the week?
Oh, I don't think we're going to see a czar. I mean, we'll be lucky to get somebody who has enough authority to make some fast progress on this. You know, a czar isn't a good phrase. I mean, they don't have czars in Washington, but what we need is a conductor, somebody who can get all the members of the orchestra playing at the same pace and playing the same sheet of music. And right now it's more like a collection of tubas and bass drums bounding away.
Interesting. And it's a music cue as well, right, Jay? Chance to hear from the band Drums and Tuba. And it's all about the interagency game that the internet czar, security czar, is going to have to play if one is named. In Washington, D.C., James Lewis is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for that and the music cue. And now Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm getting news in this hour of two big economic reports. The Labour Department says that jobless claims dropped last week. 623,000 people applied for unemployment benefits. Continuing claims, though, rose to 6.8 million. New orders for manufactured goods shot up in April by the largest amount in 16 months. Illinois Senator Roland Burris denies that he committed any ethical violations despite newly released recordings from his phone call with the brother of former Governor Rod Blagojevich.
My whole psyche is that I haven't done anything wrong. There was no pay to play. There was no money passed. There was no fundraising, and none of that happened.
On the recording, Burris offers to write a check for the governor and then mentions that he's interested in the Senate seat vacated by President Obama.
He just mentioned it.
And in sports, 41 competitors head to the semifinals for the Scripps National Spelling Bee this morning. The final is tonight on ABC at 8 p.m. A dozen will make it to those televised finals, and the winner goes home with $40,000 in cash. I need to learn how to spell. That's all your news.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And on the line with us is Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports blogger, our sports contributor based in Brooklyn, where he joins us from this morning on the line. Unfortunately, we don't have you down here, Ibrahim. Good morning.
I miss you guys. Good morning.
Yeah, you know, it's game five for the Cavs and the Orlando Magic in the NBA Eastern Conference Finals. I don't know what you think, Ibrahim, but it seems like the Magic has really got the Cavaliers' number. They put them off their game. What do you think?
They definitely, they're a passing team. They're shooting a high percentage from the three-point line, and they're playing as the better team.
And LeBron, while he's had some unbelievable standout performances, it just doesn't look like he can maybe get over the bar here.
It's interesting. The other night, he had some glaring errors in the very end of the game, and it reminded us that he's not quite the heir to Michael Jordan as everyone wants him to be.
All right, LeBron James, of course, the star of the Cleveland Cavaliers, the global NBA star, as we've talked about many times on this program, and everyone wants him to match up with Kobe Bryant of the LA Lakers, and boy, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. Let's move to the Western Conference Final, but it could. Could happen. You called the Nuggets over the Lakers, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. What do you think? The Lakers have a 3-2 lead now.
I just want to point out that I also called Orlando over the Cavs.
Could happen.
The Lakers and the Nuggets series is a really tough, hard-fought series right now, and it's really going to come down to the seventh game, and I think the Lakers actually have the edge.
And Kobe is really at the top of his game in this series. I've watched a couple of these games. It's really amazing to watch him. He is totally focused.
A.K.A. the Black Mamba. Kobe has been on fire at the end of games particularly. His fourth quarters are memorable.
Memorable. Killer, I would call them. What do the Nuggets have to do to even this series tonight, in the next game?
They have to play with the same energy that they played with in Denver 2 games ago. Birdman has to stay high-flying and swooping down from the rafters and blocking shots. Guys like J.R. Smith and Carter have to come through because right now it seems as though Carmelo Anthony is going a little bit slower than he was in the early part of the series. He's not dropping down 30 points, so the rest of the team has to chip in. They've had balanced scoring, and they have to do that and get rebounds.
Well, as auto workers in Detroit worry about the bankruptcy of Chrysler and General Motors, they at least have the Detroit Red Wings going for them. A final thing on the NHL Stanley Cup that's now set. The Red Wings are in.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. They're 8-1 at home in the playoffs. This will be the second time in about, I think it's like 15 years that you have a repeat in the NHL playoffs. So they're going to be playing Pittsburgh. Osgood, the goalies, had 30 saves. Last night's game was sudden death. And a star was made in Darren Helm.
And the Detroit Red Wings, I mean, this is great news for Detroit, right? You got to root for the Red Wings.
They've won 4 cups in 11 seasons. They last repeated in 97 and 98. So it's definitely Detroit is flying high with the Red Wings, even while the auto game is not flying
right,
so high.
Exactly. A flat tire there. Well, let's recap. Tonight is Game 5 for the Cavaliers and the Orlando Magic. That series is 3-1 in favor of the Magic. In the Western Conference, L.A. Lakers lead that series 3-2 over the Denver Nuggets. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is calling the Nuggets and the Magic. We shall have to see. And, of course, in the Stanley Cup, it's the Red Wings and the Pittsburgh Penguins. Ibrahim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. How old is young MC? Farah Chidea finds out, sort of. Busta Move turns 20. We'll find out about that in just a moment. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you. At 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today, President Obama hosts Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This is the latest in a series of White House meetings on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came to visit. The White House wants Israel to stop building housing on disputed land. It also supports an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. Netanyahu hasn't publicly endorsed that idea. The human rights organization Amnesty International has just released its annual report. Larry Koss is the organization's American director.
The key point of the report is that underneath the economic crisis, global economic crisis, there's a growing global human rights crisis, which is being aggravated by the fact that people more and more are being cast into poverty and out of jobs and out of homes.
Amnesty also warns that rising poverty may lead to instability and mass violence. In international news, Germany's foreign minister says that the lights must not go out on Opel. Even if its parent, General Motors, goes into bankruptcy, the European Commission says that it will host talks tomorrow to coordinate government efforts to save GM's European operations. Meanwhile, Chrysler is back in bankruptcy court again today, making the case that a sale to Italian automaker Fiat is the best way to avoid liquidation. And finally, at least one man is dead after a 7.1 magnitude quake hit just off the coast of Honduras. Rescuers are now looking through collapsed homes in the area, and three Central American countries were on a tsunami watch, but that's now over. And that's a look at your news.
Thank you, Femi. Bust a Move, we just said, is turning 20. What did you dance to when you went out?
Hi, my name is John from New Haven, Connecticut, and the dance song that I recall very well back in the early 80s is the remake of, or the dance version of the song, If My Friends Could See Me Now. The dance version was sung by Linda Clifford.
Your dance hit, 877-8-MY-TAKE, and while you're at it, send us pictures of you in your dancing clothes. You'll have to scan them.
Wow, I'm sorry, that's a bad song. I love you, my brother, but that's a bad song. Anyway, moving on to more serious topics. Sonia Sotomayor is all over the news. She's President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court. And yesterday, we spoke to Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman. He mentioned this.
Justice Sotomayor will be, if she is confirmed as a justice, will be the sixth Catholic on the court, which is fairly extraordinary. But her politics, broadly speaking, seem quite different from those of some of the others on the court who tend to be on the conservative side.
Now, of the 110 U.S. Supreme Court justices throughout history, only 11 have been Catholic. If Judge Sotomayor is confirmed, there'll be six Catholics on the bench. And this dredges up the question of diversity on the Supreme Court. Less than a quarter of Americans identify as Catholic, for example. For more on demographics, we're joined in the studio by Nadine Strossen. She's the former president of the ACLU and currently a professor at New York Law School. Nadine, thanks for coming in with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Fry.
When we look at diversity in the court, you know, when you look at it, what do you see?
As a civil libertarian, I believe that every individual is different, and a complex mixture of demographic characteristics, which clearly play a role in shaping who we are, given that the rest of the world will look at us and react to us as women, as gay people, as racial minorities, as Catholics, as atheists, and so forth. But I am not an essentialist. I know that you are not defined wholly by any single factor about you, whether it be the color of your skin or the religion in which you were raised. If we look, just take that factor, since you and Noah stressed it, if we look at the Catholics who are or have been on the Supreme Court, they have been enormously diverse in their rulings and have departed from the official teachings of the Catholic Church. Let us not forget that in addition to opposing abortion rights and gay rights, the Catholic Church also opposes the death penalty. And we have quite a few Catholics on the Supreme Court right now who diverge from the official teachings of their church in supporting the death penalty.
So even the story of six Catholics on the court, if Sotomayor is confirmed, is a story of diversity. John Allen joins us from the National Catholic Reporter. He's on the phone. Is that right? There's diversity amongst Catholics that would be reflected in these six on the court?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just look at the results of the 2008 elections. Officially speaking, the bishops of the Catholic Church in the United States took a position that abortion was the preeminent issue. Many of them publicly opposed the candidacy of Barack Obama. And yet Obama captured 57% of the Catholic vote. So at the grassroots, there is a much wider spread of opinion than some of the official positions of the church would might lead you to believe. And I think the Catholics, assuming that Sotomayor is confirmed, look, there's a tremendous amount of ground between her and, say, Justice Scalia, and I think that's a good reflection of the diversity on the ground in the church.
And one of the earliest Catholics on the court, Justice William Brennan, has gone down in history as one of the most, liberal judicial activists who supported abortion rights from the get-go, who took a very strong position supporting so-called separation of church and state, even though he was a very devout Catholic. And, you know, there's an organization called Catholics for Choice, and we know that most American Catholics, as I understand, do depart from the Church's official teaching on abortion.
Well, it tells the story of the transformation of Catholicism in America, right, John, before we go?
Yeah, I mean, in not just in the ideological sense, also in the demographic sense. So Sotomayor obviously is Hispanic. Today, the bishops estimate that almost 40% of the Catholic population in this country is Hispanic. It's the only segment of the Catholic population that's growing. So she also puts a face on the sort of new look of American Catholicism.
Exactly.
Very culturally, ethnically diverse.
Well, great context. Thanks for that. John Allen is senior correspondent for the Catholic Reporter. Thanks for being with us.
I want to go back to one of these other aspects of diversity, and it really has to do with the come-from-behind economic standpoint.
It shocked me, especially going on Barack, speaking up for him. I mean, it shows us that anybody can do something with themselves.
Now, Carlos Gonzalez, who we heard there, is an aspiring boxer from the Bronxdale houses in the South Bronx. And
where she grew up, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. You know, the South Bronx is sometimes stereotyped, but the reality is also that it's a tough place. And, you know, this judge did not get a lot of early breaks in life. What is that important?
I think that's very important. And actually, that is an inspiring story that even goes beyond Justice Thomas, whose story is well known of coming from behind and being a racial minority, Justice Sotomayor. Let us not forget that both Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg, who didn't come from economically deprived backgrounds, came out of law school at a time when women were enormously discriminated against in the legal profession. And in Justice Ginsburg's case, Jewish women, neither one of them, although they were at the top of their law school classes, could get a job when they graduated from law school. Justice Thomas has told me that he only got one job offer when he graduated from Yale Law School. So when all three of them were on the Supreme Court at the same time, that meant one-third of our justices could not get a job in the legal field when they graduated from law school.
Because of their racial and ethnic identity.
And that, to me, is enormously inspiring of the progress that we're making.
Too many judges, too many lawyers on this court?
I think, you know, interestingly enough, the United States Constitution does not require even that you be a lawyer to be a justice, let alone that you have had prior judicial experience. And I do think we have too few people with diverse experience outside appellate courts and law professor roles. I think it would be wonderful if we had people who had more hands-on experience in politics and also in the courtroom as litigators and as advocates. How about some defense attorneys? You know, being a prosecutor is seen as kind of the norm, whereas if you're advocating for rights of people who are convicted or accused of crime, somehow that's seen as making you a partisan or an advocate.
Oh, you raise a lot of provocative questions. Nadine Strossen, thank you so much. Nadine is the former president of the ACLU, currently professor of law at New York Law School. We also talked with John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter.
So we're dancing up a storm here on The Takeaway. It's a diverse dance party, and we're getting suggestions from all of you who 20 years ago, maybe when Bust a Move was the 1989 dance craze tune you were dancing, what were you dancing to way back when? Let me guess. Jay was dancing to that, right? RJ?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
You know,
now.
It's funny. Young MC won a Grammy in 1990 for rap. I don't know if people would even consider his stuff rap anymore. Anyway.
And music was kind of his plan B for a while, but it became his plan A. What did you dance to?
The song is Push It by Salt and Pepper.
We're always on here at The Takeaway. Send us your dance craze top hit at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. You can also podcast any of the segments you heard on the program. Go to iTunes or thetakeaway.org.
Well, MC Hammer is on Twitter obsessively. So if you're on Twitter and you want to combine the dance music thing, go for it, MC Hammer. I'm Farah Jadea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Sample got a birthday. Take yourself back to those days at school. You were thinner then, maybe even cool. Girl starts talking, guy starts talking. Sits down next to you and starts talking. Says she wanna dance cause she likes the groove. So come on, fatso, and just bust the move. It's a milestone for pop and rap, a crossover song that busts the gap. Bust a Move got a birthday today. I'm serious, it's Young MC with Farai today.
Bust it.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
That's right. Young MC with Fry today later on in the program. Good morning. It's May 28th. I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning, Fry.
Oh, boy. This is just way too much fun. I'm thinking of all the just crazy shoes I had, like clear platform shoes. Anyway, coming up this hour, our partners at the New York Times are going to give us a look at the surprising way some South Koreans view their aggressive neighbor to the north. It's more complicated and interesting than you might expect. Plus, why some parents now think the best parents barely do any parenting at all. We'll explain that new trend, all this and more ahead. But first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, new economic reports just out. A bit of good news on the job front. The number of people filing for new unemployment benefits is down. That's a surprise to analysts who expected the number of new job losses to hold steady. It seems to indicate companies are cutting fewer workers, but again, the latest report only deals with new job losses and is only for last week. The overall unemployment number is still high. Other somewhat hopeful news comes from the manufacturing world. Demand for big-ticket manufactured products soared by nearly 2%. It's the biggest jump in more than a year in the so-called durable goods. Farai?
Well, jump-starting the Middle East peace process will be the focus at the White House today. This afternoon, President Obama host Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This is the latest in a series of White House meetings on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited. Tensions are building between the U.S. and North Korea. The American and South Korean troops along the border are boosting their alert level, and this comes after a new threat of military moves by North Korea yesterday. The U.S. has had a large military presence for a very long time in South Korea. Right now, there are nearly 30,000 American troops there, and all are in range of an array of North Korean firepower, and only a thin strip of land separates them from North Korean forces on the other side.
Pakistani media are reporting two new explosions at a busy market in the country's north. It comes as the Taliban says it launched yesterday's massive attack on Pakistan's intelligence agency. The strike killed dozens and wounded more than 300. The group says it's in response to Pakistan stepped up military action against the Taliban in the country's volatile northwest.
And at least one man is dead after a 7.1 magnitude quake hit just off the coast of Honduras. Rescuers are looking through collapsed homes, and three Central American countries are on tsunami watch, but that's over now.
Quick in sports, L.A. Lakers on the verge of the NBA Finals, a 3-2 lead over the Denver Nuggets last night in the Western Conference. In the East, Orlando leads Cleveland 3-1. The Magic play the Cavaliers tonight and could close it out. In hockey, the Stanley Cup will be the Detroit Red Wings or the Pittsburgh Penguins. They begin Game 1 on Saturday. The Dow begins trading at 8,300. The S&P starts at 893 after a big loss yesterday. We're having a dance party this morning on The Takeaway. Bust a Move is turning 20, so tell us the dance tune that caused you to rock back when. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Bust the Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
It continues to act in a provocative and belligerent manner toward its neighbors. There are consequences to such actions.
And that, of course, is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry. She's talking about North Korea as rhetoric out of that country becomes hotter and hotter. Yesterday, the country's official news agency warned of a powerful military strike on South Korea if it searched the North's ships. This came on the same day the North said it no longer considers itself bound by terms of an armistice that ended the war between the Koreas 5 decades ago. Yesterday, we looked at the role of China in this brewing conflict. Now we turn to a country that's even more closely involved. We're talking about, of course, South Korea. Joining us from Seoul is Martin Fackler, who writes today for our partner, The New York Times, about a dramatic shift in how South Koreans are viewing their northern neighbors. Martin, North Korea is declaring an end to the 1953 armistice that held peace between the Koreas. It's been, in some ways, a very tense peace. So what do they really mean by that? Do they mean they're going to go back to open hostility?
It's always hard to know with North Korea because, it really is an exercise in reading tea leaves. My sense from having watched this for many years is no. I think they're just trying to get the world's attention, and they have this very sort of shrill and bellicose way of expressing themselves. I mean, frankly, they could use some better PR. But I think that basically what you see is a number of things going on. One is North Korea is developing nuclear weapons, I don't think as an offensive capability, but more as a defensive one. I think that they see this as a key to their survival, that if they have their own nuclear arsenal, say like Israel does or Pakistan does, that they can ensure the U.S. will not attack them. There's also, I think, a message to their domestic audience, and I think this is one of the key facts that often gets overlooked in the coverage of North Korea. North Korea is facing a succession. The current leader, Kim Jong-il, is sick, or was sick, had a stroke apparently last year, and there's talk of maybe his son, his youngest son, being tapped to replace him. And I think that the regime, you know, this is the world's only communist family dynasty, is trying to show its own people that they are capable of protecting North Korea, that they are technically advanced, that they have the will and the wherewithal to protect their own country. And so I think this is a message from the Kim dynasty to their own people, you know, that you should stick with us. You should let us continue to lead your country.
All right. I want to talk in a second about a new initiative that may have sparked a bit of the North's anger. But when you think about South Korea and what a very different nation it is from North Korea in terms of being one of the leaders of technology, including all sorts of broadband, wireless, gadgets, gizmos, even fashion at this point, how does this nation, not just as a government but as a people, react to North Korea?
I tell you, I mean, I look at what I see on the wire and on the web, all the news reports, and they're very alarmist. But here in Seoul, I mean, it's business as usual. You know, people are at the Starbucks, they're going to the office. I mean, there really is no alarm at all. I think people here are used to it. I think that they have lived with the shadow of this very different and sometimes bizarre northern neighbor for more than a half a century. I just think that they sort of take it in stride. I think they see it as the ranting and raving of kind of a poor cousin and perhaps one who was spoiled by too much largesse.
An odd relative. I like that. You know, yesterday we learned that the Chinese interest in this conflict is avoiding 2 million refugees coming into Manchuria, and that China really wants North Korea to remain as a state as unstable as it is. What is South Korea's interest here? You've described a kind of South Korean macho for dealing with its northern neighbor. But does South Korea kind of wink and nod at how hysterical Japan gets over all this nuclear saber-rattling?
There's a big gap between South Korea and Japan in their perceptions of North Korea, but that's a different issue. We can talk about that. But first, with the South, the official policy is they want reunification with the North. They basically want a single country, a single Korea, and that's the official policy. However, if you actually ask them, you know, in reality, what do they want? I don't think they want to take over North Korea anytime soon. I don't think the South wants a collapse in North Korea for the simple reason is it'd be so expensive. If South Korea were to go in there and rebuild it and take it over like West Germany did to East Germany 2 decades ago, the bill would be enormous. I mean, North Korea is so far behind. And I think South Koreans, frankly, are balking at the prospect of doing that themselves. So I think what people really want here is for North Korea to survive in some form, to develop and maybe become more open to the world and slowly catch up. And then at some point in the future, when it's less painful and less expensive, to have a unification with the South. I think that's what South Korea really wants at this point.
So is that to say, and I'm just extrapolating from your remarks, that the nuclear issue and this sort of saber rattling is a bigger issue for Japan and the United States than it is for South Korea and China on some visceral level?
I think on a visceral level, yes. I mean, I'm obviously South Korea is much closer to all this, and people here are aware of that. But I think in terms of reaction, I mean, I see Japan as being the strongest reactor. I mean, Japan has the issue of the abductees, you know, the Japanese who were snatched from beaches by North Korean agents 2 decades ago, and some of whom, you know, returned to Japan a few years ago. People, you know, this is something people used to look at, you know, along the same lines as UFOs in Roswell, and yet it was true. North Koreans had been abducting Japanese. And just that made Japan so emotionally angry at North Korea that it would do that. I think the reaction in Japan is much stronger. Also, I mean, Japan really doesn't have that sort of power on its own to deal with the North. It really relies on the U.S. more for its defense. I mean, South Korea has this history of having fought the North. It's been facing the North for 60 years. It has a more powerful military than the North. I mean, if it came down to a swinging match now, I think the South would win easily.
You know, this conflict very much reminds me of India and Pakistan, another set of cousins who used to be one and now are two. In what ways is this conflict or these tensions different from India and Pakistan, which both have weapons, nuclear weapons?
I just don't think South and North Korea are at each other's throats like India and Pakistan are. I really think North Korea, if they're thinking about overseas issues at all, they're thinking about the U.S. They're a big threat. What they're worried about is the United States. They're worried about Iraq and regime change and that kind of stuff. And they were really shrilly anti-American under the Bush when Bush was in office. I think that's their big overseas. I don't think the overseas audience. I don't think that they're so angry at South Korea. When South Korea does something like join this proliferation initiative, that gets them going. But in most cases, I think that they're really focused on a more distant target.
Well, you know, listening to the reaction of Hillary Clinton and certainly Japanese policymakers and even Barack Obama, it's really at odds with what we learned yesterday. John Pomfret told us that his suggestion was that the Chinese would probably just say, let's go back to the six-party talks, period, the end. There'd be some hemming and hawing, but not much else. Is there a South Korean move that could change the situation here, either on the North Korean side or in terms of how South Korea faces the rest of the nations aligned against North Korea?
I don't know of one. I mean, my guess is that South Korea probably would go with what you just described, the Chinese, as thinking. You know, South Korea tends not to be very provocative towards the North. And partly it reflects, I think, maybe a feeling that the North really isn't a threat, that the North is doing this for defensive reasons because it's insecure. And the perception in South Korea often is that, you know, just don't provoke them. Leave them alone, then they
right.
won't, you know. Just don't mess with them, and they won't mess with you. I think when you get to Washington and Tokyo, you get a very different agenda, especially Washington with the whole idea of preventing the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. I mean, Washington has a whole different agenda.
Okay, this is going to have to be very quick. Do you have any sense of how the large Korean diaspora is looking at this in places like the U.S., in other parts of the West, et cetera?
I don't know. You know, I get a lot of reader response from Korean Americans, but they tend to respond more to my stories about domestic South Korean issues. I don't get much response about North Korea, and that makes me think that maybe they aren't so different, or you know, maybe not so interested in it. I really can't answer that. They don't seem to have a level of the intensity of interest, though.
Right. So it sounds like there's a bit of calm at the center of the storm. Martin, thanks so much. Martin Fackler is the Tokyo bureau chief for our partners, the New York Times, but joined us from Seoul, Korea. John.
The closer you get to North Korea, the calmer it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Strange
part. Eye of the storm.
But, you know, it is. It's still supposedly a war zone, even though that armistice was signed in 1953. So, 877-8-MY-TAKE. What did you dance to way back when?
Good morning, Shore Collins from North Dakota. I have very fond memories of moving to Joy and Pain by, I believe, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock.
And Pain.
Play it.
Come on!
Joy and Pain on The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks, Troy.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Funky Fresh for Rye Chidea, and I'm here with John the Hitman Hockenberry. We're having a dance party this morning. Bust a Move is turning 20, big dance song from 89. We want to know, what was the big dance song when you first started to go out?
Yes, my name is Jason Frank. Back in the day, it was New Order, Blue Monday, calling from Tampa, Florida.
Yes. How does it feel? Blue Monday. Tell us what your big dance song is at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And while you're at us, we want those horrible pictures of you in your dance
clothes.
No, the good
ones. They're fantastic pictures.
Yeah, yeah, that's
what
I meant.
My
take at thetakeaway.org. My take at thetakeaway.org. Take it away.
Be in our slideshow. So back in 1762, Jean-Jacques Rousseau began his how-to novel, Émile, with the words, God makes all things good, man meddles with them, and they become evil. Rousseau went on to elaborate on a child-rearing philosophy based on the concept of the noble savage, a child unconstrained by formality, discipline, traditional school, would develop naturally into a socially responsible, self-reliant adult. This was a few years before the French Revolution and the guillotine and the Reign of Terror. A few centuries later now, the noble savages on our streets and playgrounds have much better strollers. They have skateboards. There's a 21st century relook at free-form parenting. Rousseau's in that school. The pendulum is swinging. Maybe they call it free-range parenting. Lisa Belkin is all over this pendulum swing. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And she writes about new free-form parenting ideas in this weekend's issue of the New York Times Magazine. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So what is it this time? You know, it's back and forth. We need discipline and structure. We need let them go, let them roam, let them find their own center. What's the let them find their own center qualities of this 21st century relook?
Yeah, we keep trying to find the right answer, don't we?
Yep.
And we keep deciding that whoever did it last did it wrong.
Right.
So the latest is a reaction to what was last. And what was last was this really intense, and I'm not saying it's over. It's being reexamined, though. The very intense, we have to be the best. We have to start in utero. We need to schedule. We need to train. We need to get them into Harvard. We need to be the best mommy. We need to have the best stuff. And that's exhausting. And I think kind of this newest wave of moms is looking at the last wave of moms, and it seems to be mom-driven, although the dads are much more involved in this one.
So
and
it's
saying, I can't do that anymore.
So the headphones are off the abdomen, and the kids are wandering around on their own. What are moms telling you about the consequences and the liberation of this new form of parenting?
Well, the first wave, the place we first saw this was in the blogosphere. You know, it became, in the past couple of years, the thing to be proud of was being a bad mommy. We had all those bad mommy blogs.
Sure.
Ayelet at Waldman made a name for herself saying she loved her husband more than her children.
Yeah,
and we've spoken to her about
Heather
that.
Armstrong is on there, you know, talking about her postpartum depression, about, you know, screaming at her kids. It's, look at me, look how bad I am. I can one-up you in how bad I am. And I think that was a sort of a relief to be able to say out loud, I'm not perfect. And if perfection seems to be the, you know, what to expect when you're expecting ideal, well, I just can't do that.
Well, we've moved now from, I'm not going to feel guilty about this anymore, to, hey, this is actually a better approach.
Yes.
Who represents
that? That's what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
So first it was the, look at me, I stink. And I'm not going to buy into the, I have to be absolutely perfect and doting and patient and calm at every moment. And now it's become a philosophy. In the past few months, we've seen a number of books out there that are fascinating in how they turn this on their head. Lenore Skenazy just came out with Free Range Parenting, which you mentioned earlier. The idea that, why can't we just let our kids roam the way we roamed? And it's a very intense look at the statistics and an argument that, no, they're not in more danger.
You know, in my parenting life, it seems to me very intuitive that what kids need to learn is how to entertain themselves and how to fill unstructured time. And the only way to do that is to give them unstructured stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
The only place, one commentator that I was interviewing said recently, the only place that kids are making their own rules now is online, is in video games. You go to any sports center, you know, you go to a baseball field, you go to a soccer field, there are uniforms and an adult. they don't just go out to the ballpark and come up with their own rules and referee themselves. The only place they do it, actually, is video games, which is really very sad. They don't know how to do it anymore, which is why they get to college. And they're, many of them, incapable and on the phone with mom and dad every couple of minutes asking for advice because we've never let them.
Lisa, do you have any information on how this plays out by income or class? Because it's one thing to say, oh, just let your kid out on a bike. But, you know, I remember when I was a little kid living in New York City, I had a bike stolen in Central Park. And so, you know, by no means living in a bad neighborhood, but it was just, you know, you got to be rough and ready. And the kid was bigger. I think that it really must be situational. And how do parents make that judgment? You know, do parents in this day and age even know how to make those judgment calls about what's safe and what's not if they've been overprotective?
I don't think we have a sense of what the real risks are. I was stunned to find out what the actual risks of some of the things we are so afraid of are. When you break down, I mean, the biggest one, the child abduction statistics, the thing we fear, the kid disappearing because some big bad person kidnapped them and killed them, 115 times a year. In the whole of the United States. 800,000 kids are reported missing every year, but more than half of them show up back home. So we're very, very afraid of things that don't really happen terribly often and probably don't happen any more often than they used to. We just hear about it more.
Well, that's the takeaway. Loosen up, parents. You write about it in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Lisa Belkin is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Freeform Parenting. It's a Rousseau Redux in the magazine this Sunday. Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes past the hour. The Israeli government has rejected U.S. calls to stop all expansion of its settlements in the West Bank. This reaction comes just as President Obama prepares to meet with his Palestinian counterpart in the Oval Office today to talk about Middle East peace. The White House also wants to stop what's called natural growth in the West Bank, which is new construction to accommodate the expansion of families already living in settlements. In the Middle East, Pakistani media reports that two blasts hit a busy market in the northern city of Peshawar today. That's after the Taliban claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb that killed dozens in the eastern city of Lahore yesterday. And in sports, the LA Lakers are just a game away from the NBA Finals. They took a 3-2 series lead over the Denver Nuggets last night in the Western Conference. In the Eastern Conference, Orlando leads Cleveland 3-1, and the Magic play the Cavaliers tonight. That's a look at some of the stories topping the headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with my dance partner, John Hockenberry. We are having a lot of fun because the song Bust a Move is turning 20 years old. Now, that was a huge dance song in 89. We want to know, what was the big dance song when you first started to go out? And we heard a little bit of Blue Monday, which is by New Order. And the precursor to New Order was a band led by Ian Curtis. Oh, wow, the fainting couch of goth culture. That was me, John. That was me many years ago. And we want to know your big dance song, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org, with secret pictures of you looking really gothy. Let's move on to another chapter in the tale of Rod Blagojevich and the Senate seat left behind by Barack Obama.
Oh, goody.
This one's got a soundtrack, too, but it secretly taped phone conversations between Illinois State Senator Roland Burris, who is now U.S. Senator, and the disgraced former governor's brother, Rob. Those tapes were released to the U.S. Senate Ethics Committee yesterday. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of the conversation.
So I put on a fundraiser now, and I think... It would have some, I mean, this is what I've been talking to Fred about. It has so many negative connotations that Burris is trying to buy an appointment from the governor for the Senate seat. I mean, and I'm a high profile person.
Well, he's high profile right now. With us is Rob Wildebor, a reporter for Chicago Public Radio who's been following all of this very closely. Rob, why were the tapes released now?
There's an investigation going on by the Senate Investigative Committee for the U.S. Senate, and they asked prosecutors for information relating to Burris and kind of the circumstances surrounding his appointment to the U.S. Senate. And so prosecutors basically went to the judge and said, hey, we'd like to release these tapes to the investigators, so they released them now.
Geez, he doesn't have a friend in the world. And from the sound of it, too, at the time of that Senate seat opening, he was having some pretty tough financial difficulties. Here he is again with Blagojevich.
How's your business, by the way?
It's terrible.
Is it? I'm sorry to hear that.
I mean, you know, Fred and I, we might lose Burris a little bit because we've been trying to get contracts. We don't have any clients renewing for 09.
No kidding.
Fred is dying on the vine because a lot of our clients have run out.
Yeah.
And so we're thinking about, you know, going our separate ways.
Mm.
And I'm going back into the law practice rather than the consulting business because we don't have any clients. And anything I get would be out of my personal funds because ain't nothing coming in from the business.
Well, that was a little bit of the backstory about why Roland Burris might have been eager to get a new job. That was that's a little bit of fresh meat right there. What's being made of that?
Not too much. It's no doubt that he wanted a new gig, but he also, you know, you got to remember this is a guy who's been in Illinois politics for a long time, and he is. You know, wanted to be – this is the crowning achievement of his career, to be a U.S. senator. So there was more than just the paycheck for Roland Burris in this. This is a guy who's held statewide office – different statewide offices here. And this is – you know, this is good for the ego as well to be a U.S. senator.
Well, he's certainly been facing a ton of scrutiny.
Why in one phone call would you discuss a campaign contribution and the Senate seat? That sounds like pay to play.
No. Read the transcript. The transcript show.
In the transcript, you discuss a donation and you request the Senate seat.
I cannot contribute any money because of a conflict. I also said in the transcript, it seemed like I'm trying to buy the seat.
There's like 10 campaign commercials in there for an opponent of Burris's.
Yeah. Well, you know, what strikes me is that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. was also he had to go on ABC, for example, to answer for whether or not he was trying to do some backdoor fundraising for Blago. You know, he was immediately out of the running. And this guy Burris was assumed by some people, at least when the story first broke about who was going to get the seat, assumed to be, you know, a little bit of the country bumpkin type, who was a nice guy who just wandered into this enormous plum of political appointments. How has the vision of who Roland Burris is changed, particularly in Chicago?
This was supposed to be the crowning achievement of his career, you know, his high political office. But it's really destroyed his legacy, and especially the way he's handled it since the appointment. I mean, people thought it was curious that he would accept the appointment from Blagojevich when Blagojevich was being investigated for trying to sell this Senate seat. But then since then, his story has been shifting and changing so much. He's just lost a lot of credibility because the story of what exactly transpired around his appointment has changed so many times, and there have been so many different variations about it. And that's why you hear, you know, reporters going after him like we just heard in that piece of tape. And in February, reporters were going after him, and, you know, it was – very quote-unquote fruitful because he kept changing his story and because he just brought down a whole bunch of trouble on himself by what kinds of things he said. He let all this kind of new details trickle out, and they were conflicting accounts, and it was just bizarre, and that's kind of continuing now.
You've got some Democrats, including Senator Dick Durbin, saying they won't back Burris for election in 2010, but is there any talk of having him removed?
There was talk yesterday. Some Republicans in the Illinois House were trying to push through a resolution urging Burris to resign, but Democrats held that back. So that didn't really go anywhere.
But a wounded Burris actually helps the Democrats if they can get a strong candidate to defeat him in the primary, right?
In some sense, yeah. There are other candidates looking to fill that seat, and if Burris were to gain the nomination in the primary, you know, he's just so muddied from all of this. It seems unlikely that he would win the general election. So to muddy him further and make sure he doesn't even get in the primary, that could work well for Democrats. And you remember back when Burris was appointed, one of the big questions was, oh, Senator Burris, have you agreed not to run in 2 years? Is that the deal? Was there some backroom deal? Well, it's not in the back room now anymore, if there ever was a deal.
Rob, thanks so much. That was Chicago Public Radio reporter Rob Wildebohr with the latest on Senator Burris, and now Femi with headlines.
Thanks, Rye. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. A roadside bomb in Baghdad killing a U.S. soldier yesterday makes May the deadliest month for the American military since last September. To Asia next, where tensions on the Korean Peninsula are rising. Today, the U.S. and South Korea raised their military alert levels for troops based there after North Korea threatened a military strike. The U.S. has about 30,000 troops stationed in South Korea. The Israeli government has rejected U.S. calls to stop all expansion of its settlements in the West Bank. That's as President Obama prepares to meet with his Palestinian counterpart in the Oval Office today. Now, this is a part of a series of White House talks on the Middle East peace process. That is a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And General Motors, back to the auto industry for a moment, General Motors has 100 years in the books. And they may be hours away from declaring bankruptcy as the final negotiations with bondholders appear to be going south for the company. Will Markham, GM worker, a member of the United Auto Workers of America and a friend of this program, joins us now. Will, two milestones at once, 100-year anniversary just passing and the impending bankruptcy. What's on the mind for someone like you? The workers really are the continuity of this company at this point.
Well, currently, all what we're taking care of today and tomorrow is we're ratifying our modifications, you know, trying to stay out of this bankruptcy if indeed General Motors does go to bankruptcy.
Now, I've read that among one of the things that is not resolved for General Motors is the level of layoffs and cutbacks and even the final disposition of things like Saturn and Hummer.
Agreed. There's still different plants, but according to our new modified agreement, we did get some assurances that the taxpayers' monies that's going to be used for this bridge loan, that the majority of it is to be kept to strengthen the American industry and not to take it overseas. So we were able to negotiate some language on that.
Now, is it the case that General Motors is asking, or what's left of General Motors is asking, for $50 billion additional dollars from the federal treasury to make this restructuring play out all the way?
You know, I'm really not up on what the dollar figure is at this time. I only know the contractual side of the union, and I know we've done everything in our power and the unions already come to the table before they went to bankruptcy. We've done everything we can do, and we're not holding out like the bondholders. So if we go into bankruptcy, it'll be the bondholders doing.
And if the UAW ends up holding, a significant stake in this company, perhaps 39%, perhaps, even less, what do you have at the end of the day?
Well, hopefully we'll have more say. There's been, not to sound arrogant, but as a union, we felt that we've seen a lot of this coming for a lot of years and have tried to be that voice of reason. And because of certain financial decisions, they didn't listen to us. So hopefully it'll give us more say and maybe we can head off some of this. We didn't agree with the Delphi split off. Delphi went into bankruptcy. Now we're having to buy some of it back because we're so dependent on those parts. So
interesting. It's a good point, Will. You make a really good point. It's just crossing the wires now from the Associated Press. The GM is going to make another offer to the bondholders if they agree not to oppose the Chapter 11 asset sale. What's your reaction to that? And what's the general feeling about the bondholders by UAW rank and file?
Well, we feel that that's where the problem's been all the time. The union's taken a bad rap, and really we've always catered to the bondholders and the stockholders, and that's why so much of the American work, and maybe not even when they talk about the possible vehicles that we have put out on the market, has been catered to those people more than, say, us who do the assembly.
Well, and look into a very uncertain future, to use a cliche I don't like to use, but we have to here. Will Markham, GM worker, member of the UAW, thanks for joining us from Pontiac.
Thanks for having me again.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry. We have been having this crazy dance party on The Takeaway. We're talking in a moment with Young MC, marking the birthday of a song, Bust a Move, which is turning 20 years old. It's a big dance song in 89. We want to know, what was the big dance song when you first started to go out?
This is Susanna King calling from Aiken, South Carolina, and we used to rock out to Sir Mix-a-Lot back in the day, Yeah, it's efficient and I'm away from home in the black Benz limo with the cellular phone.
I'm calling up the posse, it's time to get to ripping. I'm freaking each sunroof to keep you suckers tripping.
Oh, that's great. That's and good. We want to know your big dance song at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now we have Femi with the headlines.
Thank you, Fry. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting some news in now, some very tentative news from Associated Press. General Motors Corporation Bondholders Committee have accepted an amended debt offer. Now, stocks are trading sharply higher at this news. It may not save GM from bankruptcy, but it does look like the bondholders have accepted an amended debt offer.
So they've accepted a deal which keeps them out of bankruptcy, which keeps them from pulling the trigger.
It may well do. Big news also today. President Obama hosts the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This is the latest in a series of White House meetings on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The White House wants Israel to stop building houses on disputed land, and it also supports an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. A mega merger from the dot-com boom years is now ending. Time Warner is splitting from AOL after a decade together. This means that AOL will be its own company sometime around the end of the year. And finally, the Olympics of Spelling wraps up today. The Scripps National Spelling Bee semifinals start in just under an hour. If you've missed any of it, here's a quick recap.
May I have the language of origin, please?
Italian. Any of a large class of organic compounds.
Roscato. Correct?
Okay, those kids are amazing. You can see them in action at 8 p.m. tonight for the finals on ABC.
Our Femi with a spelling bee mashup. That's fantastic. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
busted.
All right. You know it. You were wearing those parachute pants and those kind of like shiny shoes that you thought were so fly. And you know that, especially if you're black, you had some kind of texturizer in your hair. You were listening to Bust a Move by Marvin Young, or Young MC. Now, this proud papa has a song that is 20 years old. That song is old enough to go to the club. Crazy, huh, Marvin?
Yes, Farai. The song is old enough to go to the club, get in all kind of trouble.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, your song is a classic dance floor jam. And so I want you, and I'm going to call you Marvin or Young or Young MC. Marvin is the name that your friends call you. Young MC is how most of us know you. So, Young, take me back to where you were and who you were 20 years ago when this song hit the airwaves.
Oh, boy. Well, I was just graduating college, and I had actually written not only Bust a Move, but I'd written Wild Thing and Funky Co Medina in my dorm at, on the campus of the University of Southern California.
For Tone Loc.
Yeah, those two for Tone Loc in Los Angeles. So where I was I was watching Tone blow up, you know, selling 2 and 3 and 4 million copies with Wild Thing and Funky Co Medina, and I was hoping that I could even just, like, crack an eggshell with my little record.
Well, you know, there's that whole term crate digger for people who really go out and try to find the breakbeats. And so it's a lot easier now with Google. So when I was searching, I found this song from Ballin' Jack.
Yes.
So what was it that made you find that? How did you even find that song?
Well, here's the interesting part is that I just rapped on it, and Matt Dyke, who is a legendary DJ in Los Angeles, he had the record collection. Like, he was one of those people that had records that took up entire rooms, and he had the Ballin' Jack.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you have that. The beat is Let's Jam Radioactive is the drum beat. Son of Scorpio is one of the bongo breaks. There's also an element from a Bette Midler disco record.
Get out of here.
In there. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I don't know if I'm letting cats out of bags, but that's it. And also Flea for the Red Hot Chili Peppers play bass on it.
So yeah.
There's
yeah.
a lot of elements. Yeah, there's a lot of elements that came from a lot of places, but I wasn't producing. I didn't produce that. I literally just came, you know, got a ride from my college dorm to go to the studio and just drop lyrics over the top of it. And then they had a girl, Crystal Blake, sing the hook, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So were you one of those kids who would go to the barbecue and rhyme and, like, your family go, hey, look, he done it such a good job?
No. You know what? My family wasn't all that into it. It was a hobby for me, and it was a hobby throughout high school. I DJed my prom. I mean, just I was a music head, but school always came first. So I graduated from USC with a bachelor's in economics.
Wow.
I was planning to get a regular job, and I basically took the summer to go ahead and follow the music thing. And if by fall nothing had happened or I wasn't making money, then I would turn around and need to go to grad school or get a regular job. And then that's the summer of 89 where Bust a Move essentially took off, and I've been doing it ever since.
So we know that Bust a Move has been this cultural touchstone over and over and over again. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm still making music. I've made probably about 7 or 8 albums since. I think Relentless I just released at the end of last year, and I believe that was my 8th album. And a lot of the stuff you can find on iTunes and Rhapsody and Napster and all that stuff. I've also been lucky enough to get a lot of the music that you don't know from me placed in film and TV and video games. So I have 2 songs in the latest Tiger Woods video game. I had a placement in Scrubs and Ugly Betty in the latest Knight Rider. That's pretty much what I've been doing.
What made you the kind of person who, at least from this end of the mic, we're not in the same place, seems like a grown man who knows what he wants, who's not tripping, as opposed to someone who either is the washed up has-been or the egomaniac? I mean, what makes you you?
There's a couple of things. I mean, I learned early on, my parents raised me real well, so I knew the value of a dollar, and I had a plan B. So I went to college, got the degree, was ready to go that route, get a job like everyone else and do normal things. And I always had that as a fallback position. So when I'm sitting in there taking meetings with record executives, a lot of times me being college educated, I was as educated, if not more so, than they were. So, you know, it's funny, too, because the legend's kind of grown. Like, there's people that ask me if I went to an Ivy League school, if I have my master's, my doctorate, because it got around that I took care of my business and I kind of knew what I was doing. So for me, that's not necessarily a bad image to have. So I let people kind of run with that. But my whole thing was, if this is what I do for a living, then I'm really going to take it seriously. It's basically having a blue collar mentality. Even though you may make white collar money at times, you got to be on it, like, you know, like the plumber, like the electrician, like the person going out there, you know, building the buildings or whatever. You have to be out there, you know, grinding just like everybody else.
Well, you, of course, are still doing music. And there was one song, you've got some of your tracks available online on your youngmc.com website. And one of them that just cracked me up is about social networking and the lies that we tell.
A show out west. I clicked on a page, went to her site, and I knew right away something was not right, because the age on the page said 21, but her favorite TV show was Sanford and Son. The picture looked close.
Oh yeah, her favorite TV show was Sanford and Son. And let's see, that would have been back when I was in elementary school, and I am nowhere near 21 years old. I mean, you must just have fun with this.
A lot of fun. That song is called Picture on Your MySpace Page, and the thing is, I'm probably around your same age, and I got to MySpace a little bit late, got to Facebook a little bit late, not Twittering yet, but MySpace was my first introduction to it. And one of the things that really tripped me out about MySpace is that you could pretty much lie about who you were. Like,
in
you could
every
see
way.
Somebody, in any way, you could see somebody, you know, with the wrinkles on their arms, you know, and they're 27. Like, I've never seen so many 27-year-old women in my life. I've never seen so many 29-year-old people in my life. It's hilarious.
Definitely.
Everyone's getting
hilarious.
Younger.
Yeah, in their own mind, with their own pictures. Grammy winner Marvin Young, a.k.a. Young MC. So thanks so much. Happy anniversary. Bust a move. You know, you've inspired me. I'm feeling like it's that time of the show for a dance break. I don't care what you're doing. Put it down. Take a moment. John, you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Jay, hit it.
Bust it.
Well, you know what I'm going to do right now is ask people to send us pictures of what you looked like at the club when you were dancing to this tune.
They're going to have to scan those old pictures.
It's true. Or, you know, probably somebody already tagged them on Facebook and then you're trying to take them down. We want to see your MC Hammer pants, your crazy perms. Please email them to us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. I promise I will bring some in. If you missed
I'm John
anything,
Hockenberry.
If you missed John Hockenberry, I'm Farai Chidea.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway,